Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You're tuned into another episode of Real College Podcast, and I'm your host, Casey McCabe. With the end of another school year comes the inevitable graduation of our seniors. This semester, our very own executive producer, Nathan Fervoy, graduated and has moved on from Radio K. In Nathan's absence, we will be listening back to some of the profound work he accomplished here while at RCP. Coming up, we have an examination of the police's role on campus, interviews with local characters, the legend of Mount Trashmore, and tales from Lollapalooza. Be sure to stick around. During his time at RCP, Nathan took an interest in the relationship between the U and Cedar Riverside, a neighborhood bordering the campus's West Bank, comprised of predominantly immigrants. Due to the death of George Floyd and the subsequent protests around the world, the relationship between the university and Cedar Riverside is under increased tension.
The Safe U and Timely Warning Alert System is meant to communicate and help keep the campus community safe. But the vague messages highlighting crimes in the area are something many students and faculty are critical of. I looked into whether the system might also be contributing to a safety bubble, serving students at the expense of a neighboring community. The University of Minnesota, as you might have noticed, is massive, spread out over hundreds of acres with its own governing system, recycling plant, and police department. Vice President of University Services, Mike Berthelsen, puts it this way.
The university, in many respects, operates as a city. So we have our own police department. If you call 911 on campus, it goes to our dispatchers, which then dispatch our police department. So we are independent, and it's operating as a city within the city.
Not only does the U operate as its own self-contained city, but it feels quite self-contained to the students who attend full-time. Most services, academic or otherwise, are provided for on or near campus, meaning there's rarely a time students will find they need to venture far outside their bubble. Yet, of course, while it might be easy for students to forget, the main campus sits within the major urban center that is Minneapolis, home to over 400,000 in an environment likely quite different from the suburbs many students are coming from.
Like, what does it mean to live in a very urban environment in the middle of a very large metropolitan city? And
Berthelsen and the university police department he oversees are tasked with keeping the campus safe, from broad threats like extreme weather to the pointed assault, a major piece of which they believe is making the campus community aware of possible threats.
Because we want make sure people are aware of what's happening around them, but that may not.
The new SafeU Alert system is the central tool safety services have at their disposal for reaching students and faculty at all hours via either email, text, phone, or a combination of the three.
Are you aware of the SafeU notification system?
Yeah,
100%.
Yes.
It centralizes the formerly separate timely warnings and cuts out the middlemen, giving UMPD the discretion to send out alerts directly, all with the goal of improving speed.
It should be, as soon as possible, which I feel like if you're warning people about a suspicious person, like, if we don't know, like, an hour after it happens, like, there's no point, really.
I've identified that the timing of our response we didn't feel was adequate in the turnaround of our communications. And so, but I think the general theme of us wanting to communicate has been the same. What's shifted over time is technology. A long time ago, it was tone alert radios, then email, then now what's happened is the proliferation, of course, of smartphones to the point that the vast majority of people have a smartphone with them at all times.
I asked if this development in alert technology has made campus a safer place overall.
That's a good question. I think it has allowed us to communicate better and has it made us safer? There's lots of variables to that. It gives us the capacity to give us another tool to help people have the right information to make safe choices.
Do you remember receiving the rabid bat notification?
Yes. Yeah.
So I do remember that. Right, yeah. In the mall, I think it occurred.
Now, students are probably familiar with this year's Rabid Bats and Tween Scooter Gang incidents. The campus-wide alerts are one of the few commonalities between all students at this large university. Sent out to each and every student phone, they feed conversation between classmates and a strong campus meme collective.
Yeah, and do you remember receiving, like, the most recent one, for example?
But there is also the sense among some that the system might also be feeding into long-standing narratives of fear and division between campus and its surrounding communities.
Person that was either assaulted with a gun or something happened, someone had a gun, but yeah.
For new freshmen at the U, a common message to hear passed around by peers is, bring your pepper spray if you're going out near the west bank of campus into the Cedar Riverside neighborhood.
I think it's just known through the U not to really be on West Bank alone at night. It's just kind of known not to be there. I remember when my brother showed me around the U, he was like, don't go here at night, and that was it. I was like, okay.
Cool. Placed into its proper context, the message to stay away, coming from predominantly white students about the only community boarding the U with a large African immigrant population, becomes tinged with race. A 2019 survey of students by the Minnesota Student Association presented these numbers. Under 2% of students live in the Cedar Riverside neighborhood, while over 20% live in Dinkytown, another neighborhood bordering campus. And while the vast majority of students visit Dinkytown frequently, nearly two-thirds of students responded that they never visit the Cedar Riverside neighborhood for recreational purposes. The survey fits with the general sentiment students shared about the western border of campus, that Riverside Avenue is the edge of the student bubble and a divider between the two communities.
That went out just like a day or so ago.
Yeah, there was an armed robbery, I think, on Riverside, which happens like every weekend, but for some reason we can't seem to figure out like the idea of patrolling that area when it's literally...
Another sign of the divide is the differing feelings towards the police and the two communities. While there is no consensus among students regarding police on campus, across Riverside Avenue, the feelings are consistently negative.
I just don't like the police. The police... our tyranny. They're like tyrants. You know what I'm saying?
Has it gotten, like, physical? Has it gotten rough?
It is. I got slammed a year ago over here by police.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't like the U of M being around where I live because they have their own type of police. And that, like, makes it, you know, it makes it weird when UMPD police comes to my property looking for somebody, you know.
That does not live here.
And then he, like, eventually, he thinks I'm that person, and he stops me and some shit, you know?
So, racial profiling.
Turns out that while the divide keeps most students out of Cedar, the university police, primarily tasked with protecting students, do indeed cross over, something Berthelsen confirmed.
Our staff are, you know, as needed, in cooperation with Minneapolis police, will assist or support them.
The UMPD, combined with the regular Minneapolis Police Department, result in a heightened presence of police in Cedar, a presence that no resident I spoke with felt as beneficial to the community.
Yeah.
We need the police to do better. We need the police to protect everybody, the neighbor, the community, you know, and, you know, just be fair, and we all want to feel safe and know that the police are there to protect us. And if we don't feel that, then that causes a problem, and it's sad, but yeah.
And half of the cops who are established here, they don't really live in the neighborhood. So a lot of them, like, they come with this fear of, you know, whatever their training was based off. And they need to just come in the community. Just, you know, on every vehicle it says to protect and serve. Like, come protect and serve and break bread and get to know us and get to know our parents and get to know our siblings. And a lot of these kids, like, they get, like, the wrong rep, or, like, people don't really, like, you know, they stigmatize them just because of, like, maybe, like, one bad apple caused something or did something bad, just, and then due to, like, you know, layers of setbacks, layers of, like, you know, obstacles that they're going through. And say,
residents of Cedar Riverside don't hide the fact that their community has its share of serious issues. In fact, my short visit to the neighborhood happened to overlap with a public memorial of 29 candles representing the 29 young lives lost to drug overdoses in Cedar since January.
I knew some of these brothers, some of these sisters, in fact.
If I have the resources, I really want to improve this community because a lot of youngins out here don't really, I don't think we really get enough support to improve ourselves.
This lack of essential resources and support exists right alongside the vast financial and academic resources of the U. Yet the invisible divide between the communities may be stopping the possible exchange.
A high-end university that have like the toppest, you know, technology and resources right there.
Yeah.
But yet because of some weird invisible barrier that you can't see, I feel like you're not allowed to access these resources that could use. Like, this neighborhood doesn't have a library. Meanwhile, yeah. There's a giant library right there. But
hi!
Hey.
Hello.
What's your
My
name?
Final question for Vice President Berthelsen was if the UMPD or University Services were aware of this division and if they were taking measures to address the larger issue.
You know, I'm aware that I don't think there's a great deal of interaction between the neighborhood and the West Bank of the university.
While efforts have been made to reduce negative stigmatization and retaliation as a result of SafeU alerts by removing identifying traits deemed unnecessary, no program is currently in place to bridge the divide.
You know, we do pay attention to the neighborhood relations and how we work with the city of Minneapolis, but we don't have a particular outreach program today that goes beyond that.
What's your favorite thing to do in this neighborhood?
Having fun.
For students, one Cedar Riverside resident has this message as an alternative to fear.
Tell your classmates that there's a lot of good restaurants.
Yeah, I was going to ask.
They have sambusa. You know, sambusa is very good. It's very popular. Everybody loves sambusa, no matter what culture you're coming from or background. So it's very delicious. So people come and check the sambusa, do it in a tattoo. We have a lot of things. We have good clothes, you know. So let's get to know each other and, you know, build a long-lasting relationship.
As a freshman at the U, I took my cues from my older peers, one of which being Nathan when I started volunteering for RCP my freshman year. One question Nathan answered for me was what were the motives of the so-called campus yellers.
Among the most peculiar characteristics of life on campus is the dozens of promotions, advertisements, corporations, scams, religious institutions, campaigns, and motivated individuals who set up shop along the most trafficked corridors of school, hoping to snag a wandering student's attention. For those selling something, a mass of impressionable young people this large is the perfect place to recruit a lifelong customer. Of everyone that descends upon the students, the most unique voices are surely those of individual people like Parnell, a campus minister who can be found most days talking to students and handing out pamphlets regarding Christianity.
Minister. And so I'm an advisor to several student groups on campus that are Christian motivated, and our mission among the finer details is to introduce people to Jesus Christ and to the Bible and to the saving message.
Parnell is perhaps most infamously known for passing out the Myth of Evolution flyers at certain points in the year, though it is only a portion of his mission.
I think it was
another controversial figure on campus this year is Jonathan. Jonathan is younger and a bit more extravagant than Parnell, often carrying signs boasting a myriad of conspiracy theories.
Yeah, could you read the one that you have with you right now and then just like talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so the one I got right now is it says fluoride causes cancer.
The messages these men are attempting to spread are far outside the norm and clearly are not accepted by the vast majority of students they speak to. Yet day after day, they continue to preach. Regardless of my opinion of their opinions, I had to admire the resilience and grit returning to campus again and again, even after days of no visible progress.
I mean, the majority of people I talk to don't respond to the message and treat it like it's, you know, that's nice for you kind of a thing, or worse. But you know, when I take that back to the Lord and say, you know, you want me to go somewhere else, do something else, I feel like the Lord's saying, no, I want you to stay where you're at. So
when one single bit of negativity can dissuade me from ever trying something again, I can't help but wonder what thought processes allow one to be so committed to a cause.
It upsets me, and other times I just really couldn't care. But I feel like it's always worth it. I think that, you know, even if I get a disagreement, then at least I can sort of bring the topic into their mind, and maybe they research it more and change their mind later, or maybe they're more willing to talk about it with other people, or maybe they'll badmouth me to other people behind my back, and whoever they say it disagrees with them, and then I've informed someone through a third party. So
my work is an action of faith. You know, it's like I'm called to obey the Lord and to discharge the mission that He's given me. And apparently that mission is a lot about sowing and not a lot about reaping. A lot of, you know, in a sense, in farmer terms, it's, you know, we're working the ground, we're planting the seeds, we're watering the soil. Not a lot of seeing the increase or the harvest. So no, I don't see a lot of people respond to the message and become believers from start to finish. But I believe that, I mean, they say that, you know, someone has to hear the good news about Jesus Christ potentially up to seven times before they take action on it. And so sometimes I'm the first person.
I also wonder, how did you get here, as I talked to Jonathan Parnell? What influenced you to wake up one morning and decide to stand up in front of thousands of people who will all almost certainly chastise you? To this, their answers were simple, similar, and eerily familiar.
Coming to school, dealt with a lot of depression, you know, kind of a lot of anxiety, kind of trying to suddenly be responsible,
yeah.
You know, and thinking I got to know it all, but finding out that I don't know that much, you know. So I kind of went through my junior year, you know, making friends and still partying a little bit and doing all right in school, but kind of like, what's my purpose in life, you know? But I think I put two and two together and realized that I'm an average guy as far as my skills and intellect. And I was thinking to myself, you know, am I going to succeed in this world, or, you know, should I begin to look for something deeper, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But I was just searching, and then I met a guy in Kaufman who had a quiz, you know. Back then they could give away pop, you know, so answer the quiz, get a free pop, you know. What are the five religions of the world? And so I answered them, got a pop, and the guy started asking me questions about spiritual life, you know. Do you believe in God, you know? Do you believe in the Bible? Do you have a relationship with God, you know? And never had those conversations before, so I said, well, I believe in God. I don't believe in Jesus Christ. I believe the Bible is written by men and is full of contradictions, you know. And he said, well, you ever read the Bible, you know? And I was like, well, no. He's like, well, would you like to?
There was actually also a preacher I should mention. His name is Mike. I want to say his name is Mike, but when I was in college, this guy would stand outside Walter Library and he would stand on like a chair or something, and he would just read from the Bible page after page.
Mm-hmm.
I think if it wasn't for him, I would have forgotten. I would have been really lost without him, without just that guy reading the Bible every day. Like, he kept the thought of, he kept God in my mind, I guess you could say.
Yeah, yeah.
After I graduated and came back, I've seen him like in Dinkytown a few times. I went up and I told him, you know, how much, like, seeing him read the Bible to while I was in college helped me, I guess. It was inspired me, I should say. And I feel like I want to inspire others in the same way.
Both Parnell and Jonathan are here on campus because this is the model that was handed down to them. For assurance that what they are doing is having an impact, they need not look farther than themselves. Both learned of what they now preach as students very much like those they now preach to. And so by continuing in place of the preachers that inspired them, they will likely pass the baton down to the next generation. In this sea of many thousands of impressionable young adults searching for answers, only one has to take the bait for the cycle to continue.
Well, there's like four things that I want everyone to know. I'm telling everybody anyways. It's that fluoride causes cancer. There's fluoride in our water. And the Earth is not a spinning ball. Evolution is a lie, an intentional lie. And that God is real. And the Federal Reserve is a private bank. And it's corrupting our country.
Cool. Yeah, all right. Thank you, Jonathan, for talking with me.
My pleasure.
Radio K, Real College Podcast.
As an out-of-state student, Nathan took an opportunity to put his hometown on display for RCP.
Well, my sensations are picking up. Is I see a lot of green, a big, massive hill that doesn't look like trash very much. I see tennis courts right in front of me as we approach it. The soccer goals, people walking by, a lawnmower coming over, picking up young trees, lawnmower stuff,
old trees,
and a lot of trees in the hill. Hilly section,
the Trashmore
section.
A well-known landmark in Evanston, in North Chicagoland, Mount Trashmore stands out as the only elevated ground for miles around. The man-made hill attracts the younger members of the community year-round for its views, recreation, and for a chance to speed down its steep sides.
All right, Mount Trashmore, it's pretty weak, to be honest. It's like the highest in the air you can get in the state of Illinois, and it used to be made out of trash, so there's hella diapers in here and shit. And they just covered it in dirt. They covered it in dirt, and now there's some grass growing on and some trees, and I once tried to plant a weed plant here when I was like 15, and it didn't work at all because I forgot where I planted it. I like put a piece of trash, and I was like, I'll remember this piece of trash. And I remember it, so this shit's pretty weak, but the view is like nice. It's like a 4 out of 10. You could see like a third. You could see like a third of the park from here, and the train tracks, and Home Depot.
Over here, though, that's pretty sick view.
Yeah, you can actually see Chicago a little bit. You can see Chicago. I can see the Sears Tower from here, which is pretty cool, but it's real tiny.
My name is Bob Dornicker. I'm with the city's Parks and Recreation Department. My role here at the city is I am the Assistant Director of Parks, Recreation, and Community Services. I've actually worked for the city for over 25 years in various capacities, and I work for one of the greatest departments in the city, Parks and Recreation, Quality of Life Department. James Park was once a city trash dump way back, and I believe the city actually purchased a property in 1948, used it for a trash dump for a number of years, and then in 1970s it actually put together a plan to develop the site into a public park, and that's actually our largest park site here in Evanston for athletic fields. As part of that development, the city actually built a large 65-foot tall sledding hill, and when they first started putting it together back in the late 70s, early 80s, there was actually toboggan slides there at the site, as well as tow ropes. It was like a mini ski resort. You were able to actually rent skis at the field house was constructed, and you could go check them in and out for the day.
I remember there was the big hill in the middle, and the medium hill, and then the small hill, and then the big hill, someone broke their neck on the fence in between the two hills, and then it was like a $2,000 fine for a year and a half if you went on the big hill. That's what I remember, just sledding.
Damn, people still sled though. So.
Yeah. I remember going down the backside of this very hill.
The backside is the suicide side.
And ramming into a
Someone
fence.
Broke their neck down.
On Ty's tube.
Yeah.
And it was real fun.
Someone died.
So it's really changed over the years. One of the things that's happened is that the toboggan slides are gone. All of the tow ropes are gone. We no longer even had to go back to, you know, when we were doing the skiing out there, we actually had snow making equipment there that's all been removed. And it's actually the hill itself is more of a passive space now. Some individuals will run the hill during the summer and spring months for training purposes. Now it's turned into more of a nature area than actually individuals.
Along with the untamed nature, which filled in the passive space left in the absence of winter sports, came a long line of untamed teenagers, a tribe, bored and looking for a place outside the bounds of regular society to go about their business. In the brambles behind the hill, bushes and branches block out the outside world, obscuring away the problems of those who visit. And in the same moment, sunlight streaming in between the leaves, Mount Trashmore presents a new and better reality for the mind to wander through, a reality of smoke and friends, community and hope.
Here, so you wanna go? Which way should we go?
Let's go up around where the hangout is.
Yeah.
It's sort of a knowing place. Like, I feel like the hill knows.
Uh-huh.
Like, the hill has eyes. Not in a creepy way, but in a cool way.
I'll go over there on bad days and good days too, you know, or whatever. Sit like Humpty Dumpty on that wall, and these people look at me like I got big wings, like, oh, oh, oh. How you doing, Nathan?
I'm good. What's up?
It was the spot. We all lived in South Evanston.
Yeah.
I don't really know why we started. You lived the closest.
I live at the very first house right after the train tracks. So we used to chill all the time at Mount Trashmore. And it was pretty much a normal park until you got to the hill. And then in the hill, it was just like a whole different forest. And like each different spots in each different direction were like very distinct.
It was a maze, dude.
Yeah.
Like once it grew in, it was just so hard to, you couldn't really walk through it. But when, like we were in there in the fall.
I remember having shown him some sketches that I made of Mount Trashmore, specifically the hill, and it was just like a bunch of people dancing around. It was like a bunch of different symbolism in there too, different things going on in different parts of the hill. And like, I don't know, we started talking about a summer camp kind of like music creativity festival thing where every summer people just set up, you know, tents, yurts, whatever the fuck they want. They just set it up on Mount Trashmore, and then like all summer long it's just kind of an event of creativity. Doesn't matter what you do, it's like art, music, dancing, clothes, whatever the hell you think your talent is. You just camp out there, you just support everybody else. It's kind of like, it's kind of just like a summer long of community.
That was the idea.
Yeah. I feel like a lot of people in our generation should continue to go after that vision that we had of Mount Trashmore, you know what I'm saying? Because it's like,
but what was that really? Like we were just high as hell on acid all the time.
But think about the homies at the time though. Also, you know what I'm saying? Think about how much we all were a community in a way. You know what I'm saying? It wasn't like one man for one, it was all for all, and it definitely wasn't like I would take the bullet for you, but at the same time, it
we
was
were
like
very community. We had to share everything.
I think
we had.
I think that it should just be used for more than what it's used now. Especially the hill space. The hill space is very neglected. Every other space kind of has something designated to it, but that hill space, you know, without littering it or destroying it, I think people should, you know, come together and do events on the hill also. That would be something crazy.
What brought me into this world, sort of like those times.
I could almost smell the vibe. Almost smell the vibe, dude. It's so fucking nice. It's just like coming back to an old friend.
Uh-huh.
Like smelling it, seeing it, and soon I'll be touching it, walking up it. It's like coming back to a nice place that resonates with me.
For Real College Podcast, this is Nathan.
One of Nathan's favorite interviews of all time occurred during his reporting on Lollapalooza. During his coverage, Nathan watched a drunken man attempt to sneak his way past security into the festival. This hilarious audio was the result.
He's bold, man. Just on his own.
He doesn't give a shit. Yeah, on his own. He was on some Tom Cruise. Dun, 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 dun. Mission Impossible. Oh, yeah, he definitely doesn't know where the fuck he's at. I like his shirt, though.
Yeah,
I wonder who's got on there.
I should go up to him.
Yeah, you should. Yeah.
Yo, actually, yeah, come on.
Check, check.
Yo, Doug. Yeah. That was a bold move you made right there.
What? Yo. Follow me, boy.
Yo.
Yo, we don't give a f- no ID.
Yeah.
Let's go, boy.
Hey.
Listen, here's our play. Let me get the mic.
Yeah,
mic,
I got
boy.
You, I got you. Take it.
Let me hold it. Listen. We made big moves tonight. We made big new moves with the fucking boys.
I will fight any. Listen, we'll punch anyone in the face.
Hell yeah.
I'm serious.
Deadass.
No, I'm serious.
What for?
Because we can do whatever we want, bro.
Yeah.
No, I don't think you realize we can do whatever we want, bro.
Yeah.
Thank you for all of your hard work and dedication, Nathan. Hopefully, we will see you back in Minneapolis real soon. Signing off for Radio K's Real College Podcast, I'm Casey McCabe.